What is up, fools? It's another oneliner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig, and with me, as always, Scott Morris.
Hello.
And Drew Tavendale.
Hi.
Yeah, what a beast. Let's crack on.
Yeah, what a beast. What a beast.
I don't know. I was going to say what a beast of a podcast we have lined up, and then I couldn't get the words out of my mouth, and now I've left it hanging, so it sounds like I've described Drew as a beast. Which I'm neither going to confirm nor deny. So it's a little bit of an eclectic mixture we've got for you on this occasion. First of all, what I'm gathering is a Korean gangster drama, Drew. Nameless Gangster. What's that all about?
This is a film that caught up with recently. It was released last year, but we all managed to miss it, and are generally fans of Korean cinema. Now, we're all familiar with the sorts of gangsters that typically populate crime films. Hard, ruthless men who would kill you as soon as look at you, and often sooner. People like Charlie Brigante, Tommy DeVito and Michael Corleone, who control those around them through violence, force of will, and occasionally sheer unhinged mentalness. But it never seemed to me that these archetypes were actually particularly good at business. But in Yoon Jong-bin's Nameless Gangster, we follow the story of a far less familiar type, the gangster bureaucrat. Set in the era of an actual late 1980s clampdown on organised crime by South Korean authorities, Nameless Gangster follows the rise of Choi Ik-hyun, played by Old Boy's Choi Min-sik, from a corrupt mid-level customs official at a port to one of the most powerful men in Busan. Having stumbled upon a large shipment of drugs, he attempts to offload his windfall to local gangster Choi Young-bae, who he soon realises is a member of the same clan. In an unexpected turn of events, the two decide to go into business together despite Ik-hyun drunkenly abusing Young-bae. Now, it seems that family carries even more weight in Korea than it does in the Cosa Nostra, because it's hard to imagine Michael Corleone deciding to go into business with a distant relative who had called him, more or less, a little pissant, and then gone and moaned to his father about his treatment. But get together they do, and with Ik-hyun being their brains and Hyung-bae being their brawn, the pair build their empire and make huge amounts of money, as gangsters are wont to do. Ik-hyun makes political connections and greases palms, allowing them to get licenses to open casinos and make even more money. Of course, it all eventually goes downhill, with the partnership breaking up due to greed, vanity and ambition, and all just in time for the commencement of the investigations into organised crime. Now, the performances here are enjoyable, notably Choi Min-sik, but he receives strong support from Ha Jung-woo as Choi Hyung-bae, a menacing physical presence, and Kwak Do-won as the odious, self-satisfied, and to Western audiences, improbably named prosecutor Joe Bumsuck.
Unfortunate.
It is a bit, isn't it? Writer-director Yoon Young-bin oversees realistic period detail and a grimy world where corruption is rife. He throws in a few references to the Western gangster films to which the film owes a debt, but unfortunately also copies some of their failings, notably the conspicuous absence of women in important roles. And for a fair bit of this, it's okay, I guess. It's relatively entertaining for part of it. And while Choi Min-sik's acting prowess elicits some sympathy and interest in his character Ik-hyun, the problem is that the main character is a strange one and hard to get really invested in, because he's like the Mr. Bean of gangsters. He's a bumbling fool whose drunken antics and vanity always look set to get him in trouble. And while responsibilities are split between the two partners, it's hard to believe that this total buffoon has the attributes necessary to survive in the world he's in. Whether that's worth a look, though, I'm not sure of. The problem with this being a gangster film is that the gangster isn't particularly believable as a gangster. It's something of a failing. What say you, Scott?
Yeah, I more or less agree. It sort of struggles its way up to mediocre, but it's hamstrung by its own characters. I mean, Choi Min-sik, he's doing his best, bless him. But
yeah, that's the thing, because the fact that that guy really is a good actor, and the fact you've got any sympathy or interest in this guy at all is down to him, because he's a muppet.
Yeah, the character just doesn't wash at all. He doesn't seem like he'd be tolerated for a week in this company, let alone
exactly,
what, decade and two decades, whatever this covers. And it just winds up with this completely uneven tone, because at points it wants to be taken deadly seriously with sort of the mass brawls and that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, yeah, looks like, it's almost farcical in other points.
Yeah, then like literally the frame after something like that, that's happened, and here comes drunken Nate Kung stomping around in his clown shoes, just knocking over all credibility.
Yeah.
It's like some Korean Goodfellas, but focusing only on Joe Pesci's character, and here he actually is a clown who's only here to amuse you. So it's just narratively quite flimsy as well. I felt for a film that's, what, 2.25 hours or something like that?
Yeah,
There's not really an awful lot in there. I mean, you can pretty effectively sum it up in like a paragraph or two when you're sort of doing recaps. There's just not an awful lot in the film. The tone's just all over the place. Vincent Choi's almost entertaining enough to salvage the film by himself, but not quite. I think if it had been more like 90 minutes, he'd probably get away with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he's entertaining to watch. But yeah, after 2.25 hours, you say it drags a bit.
Yeah, the cracks kind of
start. Why
hasn't
somebody just shot this guy in the face? They're gangsters, yeah. After all. They're shown several times during the film that they're quite ruthless.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe in any way that this guy would survive, let alone thrive.
I guess there's nothing outright offensive about the film. It hangs together only just well enough for it to become mediocre. It's not really doing anything too dreadfully. There's nothing that stands out as being, you know, a complete disaster. It's just mediocre in a genre that's already oversubscribed with really good films. And just the simple fact that it's Korean is not enough to recommend Nameless Gangster. It's got some pretty hard swinging company over the last like few decades, and this doesn't quite cut it. I mean, if you do wind up watching it, I don't think you'll hate it or anything like that, but I just don't think there's any reason to make any particular effort to track it down.
It's not really a complaint about the film, but are you with me in being slightly puzzled by the name?
My opening sentence to recap this would be, first off, I wish to register a complaint with an ombudsman. This film doesn't have any nameless gangsters in it. They're all named, apart from the uncredited thugs.
Yeah, well,
so unless that's who you're talking about.
Yeah, the only thing I could think was that it's because he was sort of like the power behind the throne type guy, if that's how they were setting it up, that people sort of knew the face, which was Choi Hyung-bae. He was like the muscle in the face, and the guy, he was, Choi Ik-hyun was the guy behind the scenes doing the deals. But it's not, and given that so much of the film is predicated on the importance of family name.
Yeah.
It's a very oddly named film. It's nothing to do with the quality of the film at all, but I just found that really puzzling.
Yeah.
What a mystery. Did this get a cinema release over here? Or?
I don't believe it did. It was a huge hit in Korea, though. Mm. It had like 1 million people went to see it in the first 4 days of its release.
Hot damn.
But no, it appears not to have had a cinema. According to IMDb, anyway, it only got released in Korea, Sweden, Italy, Mexico, Spain, and the USA.
Perhaps a little bit of culture clash then. It's one of those where Korean cinema, not everything translates culturally quite as effectively as perhaps even some of the Japanese stuff and whatnot, but I don't know, I haven't seen it.
No, what I don't think it's that, actually. I mean, because, as I said, the director's period detail's pretty good. It looks quite atmospheric. It's like grimy 1980s.
Grime.
And it did feel quite Western influenced. I mean, apart from the whole sort of, okay, it's a slightly different family tradition when you're talking about Koreans rather than sort of Italians, but other than that, it felt stereotypical of the genre.
It's quite clear in the likes of Goodfellas and Carlito's Way and stuff, and as I said, there are some references to that in there.
Yeah.
But the problem isn't, it's not the set, it's not how it looks, it looks quite nice. It's not even so much the story, it's the character. The big failing is the character.
Yeah.
There's certainly no way it's believable that this one character would survive in this world.
Mm.
His first meeting, he's working in a docks, he's a customs inspector, but he's incredibly corrupt, as all his colleagues are.
And at this point is all of Korea.
Yeah, that
apparently
seems to be the suggestion. Actually, it's impossible to find somebody who isn't corrupt, right? Yeah. And one night where they're probably going to get laid off because they're starting to investigate them even then, and somebody has to go to make it look like something's actually been done. He stumbles across this shipping container that somebody's trying to break into, and it's full of crystal meth. Well, the whole shipping container's not full. That'd be an awful lot of drugs, but there's a large amount of crystal meth in there. Which goes, he somehow knows somebody who knows a gangster, it seems to be the gist of it. And he goes and meets him, and then he recognises and realises he's part of the same extended family. But then this supposedly hard-ass gangster, he starts belittling him. He gets really drunk, starts belittling him, basically calling him a little pissant, saying, oh, I remember how you used to work on your father's tuna boat. And he, for some unexplained reason, doesn't get shot in the face. But that's the big feeling with the film. It's the fact that this one character who it's based around does not seem in any way feasible that he would survive in that world.
Yeah, he's not ruthless enough.
Well, he's not ruthless at all. So he's ruthless as a bit of limp celery. He's just a fool.
It's a well-known fact that the meek will inherit the earth.
I encourage you to look up the definition of fact in a dictionary, Craig.
Oh, dear. Moving on. Scott, Paul Thomas Anderson, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Joaquin Phoenix, Thinly Veiled Poke at Scientology, The Master. Discuss.
What could possibly go wrong? Paul Thomas Anderson films don't come along as often as I think perhaps most of us around this table would like.
Indeed.
We have a decade between the excellent Punch-Drunk Love and his latest, The Master, and you've only had the excellent There Will Be Blood in between, so we're roughly working on a 5-year schedules there. But I have come to think of his name as a universal badge of quality, which shows yes. what a moron I can be. So in The Master, we join Joaquin Phoenix. He's Freddy Quell, as he's been discharged from the Navy at the end of World War II, apparently suffering from some kind of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Oh, how trendy.
He has
I
been...
believe it's called being a wanker.
So he's also been self-medicating with enough alcohol to kill Boris Yeltsin. This, and along perhaps with his tendency to mix and brew his own dangerous concoctions, the secret is paint thinner and torpedo fuel leaves him with a violent nature and unable to hold down jobs, and he winds up drifting from place to place. Until one day, he jumps on board Lancaster Dodd, a Philip Seymour Hoffman's boat. Who is Lancaster Dodd? He is a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist and a theoretical philosopher. A cheesemonger, a show jumper, a rocket scientist, an experimental theologian, a candle baker, a puppeteer, a showman and a salesman, a freelance scientist, a mixologist, a spin doctor, a member of the spin doctors, the alpha, the omega, all things to all men, the light and the darkness, the wielder of the secret flame, and perhaps unsurprisingly, leader of a cult named The Cause, from what I can gather.
A lover and a friend?
Well, in his own unique way, perhaps. Lancaster Dodd is perhaps not quite as bombastic as I'm making him out to be, but of course it's quite obvious that he's drawing parallels with L. Ron Hubbard and the Scientology movement, and I suppose that's not unintentional, although I forget where we ended up with the complex legal shell game of is this, isn't this directly inspired by the notoriously litigious and mental religion. At any rate, Lancaster's peddling a similar line of self-improvement by the way of brainwashing and bullshit, although Lancaster at least does seem to believe in his methods, where I believe by most non-Scientologist-approved accounts, L. Ron Hubbard was really more of a money-grubbing charlatan than a genuinely mentally ill person believing in alien reincarnation and such like. Lancaster takes a liking to Freddy for some reason, and I suppose that's not a bad gauge of Lancaster's fragile mental state. He takes him on seemingly as a project to help him with his issues and give him purpose in life by his baffling series of applications. The bulk of The Master concerns the reactions of the adherence to the cause to Freddy's arrival and his continued antisocial behaviour, and of course Freddy's reaction to their reaction, and Lancaster lording over all of it in his uniquely self-deluded way. What isn't really covered by any of this is the whole getting insight into any of the characters thing, as the actions and motivations of everyone involved remain completely impenetrable from start to finish, and frankly I'm left with no wish to penetrate them. Now, I don't want to trivialise the plight of combatants in wars that develop post-traumatic stress conditions, especially when I'm so feeble that it takes me a few hours to recover when it's been quite busy at Asda when I'm doing my shopping, but fictional service to his country aside, Freddy Quell's a complete tool. If there's a more repellent lead in a movie over the past few years, I'd struggle to name them, and it's not repellent in the sort of wanting to find out what secrets drive this dark anti-hero, it's this guy's a shit barge, get him off my screen kind of thing.
He's quite a spectacular wanker. It's like, this guy's just such a pillar. It's like, why am I watching him? He's got no redeeming features. Please take him away.
Yeah. Hoffman's Dodd fares a little better, but only very little, but at least shows flashes of charisma amongst the daffy expositions of his belief and temper tantrums when questioned, but it doesn't add up to a particularly interesting character. Given that, to what little point I could discern for The Master, it's about a personality cult of a personality that doesn't have much of a personality, then we've kind of got issues with this film. Should, I suppose, mention that it's not really a problem with any of the actors, who are uniformly doing what they're asked to the utmost of their impressive abilities. It's just that what they're being asked to do holds no interest or conveys much of a point to any of it.
It's absolutely pointless, you're right.
There's no examination or reflection, anything that happens. It's just a bunch of loosely collected speeches and vignettes and shouting matches that tapers out to nothing and leaving nothing to hold any interest. In the interest of being at least slightly positive, it often looks fabulous, from period touches to some wonderful lighting and some scenic shots of the desert. P.T. Anderson apparently not having been slowed down by partnering with frequent cinematographer Roger Elswit, Mihai Malamera Jr. doing a great job of producing something that actually feels quite a lot like a P.T. Anderson film. I was actually surprised to find out that the DP had changed in this one. It does remind me of quite a few shots from There Will Be Blood and Punch Drunk Love even. But in the interest of being more realistic, the first time I watched this film, I fell asleep halfway through, and the second time I watched the film, I came to the conclusion that I had the right idea the first time round. Avoid.
There you go. Can't say fairer than that. So, Drew, did you have anything to add?
I had the same feelings as Scott, that P.T. Anderson was the universal badge of excellence, and I was so disappointed to find that this was the first P.T. Anderson film I've seen that I don't like.
Oh.
Now, I knew going into it, it's been talked about so much that this was about Scientology, and it's not. The main character, Lancaster Dodd, bears some resemblance to L. Ron Hubbard, but beyond that, it's not really about that. And the performances are great. Philip Seymour Hoffman is great as he usually is, but it's to no end. And occasionally the film threatens to get interesting. There's a scene where he starts having quite a lively debate with a guy who comes into one of the Causey's meetings and asks him why he's saying he can, for instance, cure cancer by taking people back to previous lives. And it's like, maybe if this is about cults, it could be quite interesting here. And they start getting into quite a vitriolic argument. And then it's like, nah, we're done with that now. We're just going to go back to the people sitting around talking for a while with no particular point, which is deeply, deeply disappointing. As Scott was saying, Joaquin Phoenix, not only is his character deeply unlikable, he's deeply weird and strange affectations too, like walking like he's got a crooked back and really, really strange things going on there that look like they're deliberate, like they're supposed to suggest something about his character, what's happened to him, but I can't work out how that is.
Yeah.
And you've got like homoerotic subtext, but they don't really seem to go anywhere, really. It's meant to be suggesting that Joaquin Phoenix's character gets redeemed, but he didn't really do anything particularly bad. He was an unpleasant character, but he didn't himself do anything bad and didn't need redeemed and didn't get it anyway. It's so disappointing. I knew going into it that it wasn't meant to have a narrative as such, and I have no problem with no narrative if it's a strong character piece, but it's not even that. You've got Lancaster Dodd, who believes in what he's doing but isn't particularly interesting. Amy Adams, who's just like a shrill wife person who is more just there to be annoying. Joaquin Phoenix, who's a complete pillock. There's just nothing in there to get a handle on. I've seen so much written about the song about how it's about America dusting itself down after World War II and all these other subtexts, and it's complete and utter bollocks. It's nonsense. I don't know what these people generally believe what they're buying. I'm thinking, oh wait, no, this is a P.T. Anderson film. There should definitely be something here, instead of just saying, calling it what it is, which is a disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
I am so sad to find that a film with this cast and this director, I didn't enjoy one bit.
Boo.
And even Johnny Greenwood's score, which was so discordant in There Will Be Blood, but worked because it matches the character's mindsets and things, and it just worked perfectly. And this is just an irritation. Quite a similar type of score, but that's just annoying. And stop that now.
I shall have to follow up on this and see what the deal is, because Boogie Nights is one of my sort of top 10 films of all time. And yes, I'm of the opinion up until this point that the man can pretty much do no wrong. I haven't even clapped eyes on Punch Drunk Love yet.
That's it. I've loved everything he's done up to this point.
And this did seem like it was setting itself up for the easy tapping. But it's
a
lot.
Yeah, but again, with that cast and what people thought it was about, which it's not really. There's semblances of similarity to L. Ron Hubbard, but not much.
Mm.
But I mean, Hard Day, it's a long time since I've seen, but I liked. Boogie Nights, I loved. Magnolia, I'm particularly fond of. Punch Drunk Love, which is really entertaining and is quite outstanding for being a truly amazing Adam Sandler performance, sits apart on its own. And then obviously There Will Be Blood, which we all around here absolutely love, and it's a crashing disappointment.
Crash. It's no secret around these parts that I harbour a massive man rod for Ryan Gosling these days. Drew, how's my boy doing in Place Beyond the Pines?
Well, if it were just as far as Ryan Gosling himself goes, then I can see your point of view, quite frankly. Pity about everything else. But let me expound upon that. Derek Chan France follows up 2010's Blue Valentine with The Place Beyond the Pines. It stars Ryan Gosling as Handsome Luke, a carnival stunt rider who makes a living riding his motorbike around a cage of death.
Not an ugly man called Trevor then, no?
No, he's not ugly Trevor, he is Handsome Luke.
Ah, okay.
In case you couldn't tell that by looking at him.
Ah, handsome bastard.
Returning with the carnival to the town of Schenectady, which he was in last in a year ago, he meets Eva Mendes Romina, a woman he hooked up with on his last visit. He discovers that she has a son, his, and he quits the fair to be part of his son's life and provide for his child and Romina. largely ignoring the man who's already doing this. Employment as a mechanic by Ben Mendelsohn's Robin eventually leads to his decision to provide for his sons by means of bank robbery, his tremendous skill as a motorcyclist integral to his getaways. The story is slow-paced, almost hypnotic, but I found actually quite compelling. Now, it achieves that in no small part due to the quiet but charismatic performance of Ryan Gosling, a type of role he excels in. For further evidence, please see Drive. While there's a sense of danger, impulsiveness and violence beneath the surface, Handsome Luke doesn't have much of a personality, and the role hinges on Gosling's charisma. And he's captivating. And from that, you might think I'd recommend this film. But, and there's a big but, this isn't one film. It is, in fact, three. And that's where things start to fall apart. The three different parts of The Place Beyond the Pines are loosely, also very loosely, linked by characters, but tell very different stories. The second part, for instance, follows Bradley Cooper's police officer in the aftermath of his path crossing that of Handsome Luke's. And then, as if the writers got bored, oh look, a bee! Hey, where were we? becomes a story about a corrupt small-town police department and political ambition. And then the third and final film is set 15 years on from the second and features two school kids who, in true Hollywood fashion, are played by a 25-year-old and a 22-year-old, with ties to the other two parts of the film, and whose paths cross due to laws of narrative convenience and massive coincidence. And by that point, it's tremendously hard to care. Aside from Ryan Gosling, the performances are reasonable, and if Emery Cohen was intentionally making his character AJ so utterly obnoxious, then he's excellent. But even Ray Liotta's intensity and Bruce Greenwood's authority can't save this from being a mess. Too much of the story simply isn't interesting, or simply isn't there, quite frankly, and too much of the rest relies on contrivance. There are clearly hints here of themes of nature versus nurture and the effects on the sons of the sins of the father. Those could certainly be interesting, but there's simply too little story to adequately service them. In the end, The Place Beyond the Pines blows the promise of its moody first chapter, and it's certainly not something I can recommend.
So there. Scott, expound.
Not really an awful lot to add. I agree pretty much entirely. It's, if we're going to be positive to start off with, it's not without its bright points. I mean, in the final analysis, this structure that it's got, the three film rather than three act structure, doesn't really work, but it's kind of interesting to watch the attempt, at least.
And to be fair to it, parts have considerably more to do with each other than something like Babel.
Yeah, and it builds up some really good cloying atmospheres at points. It's quite moody, it's quite atmospheric in places. I don't think there's really, in retrospect, I don't think, again, there's not much in here that's actually bad as such. It's just that it's not so great at capturing and holding attention after the first narrative switcheroo. The most interesting stuff gets front-loaded onto the first section, and the rest of the film is a trifle dull in comparison. I mean, I did really like the first act, if you will. Even that's not perfect, but it's really just been hamstrung by the fact that it's been compressed down to 45 minutes or whatever it wind up being.
Yeah, I think it's maybe even be as low as 40. Yeah. The first bit as a film on its own, about 80, 90 minutes, that might well have worked very well.
Yeah, because I was enjoying that. But even that sort of shows where it's hurting from its runtime reduction, because, you know, Gosling's look seems quite believable as a kind of complex, conflicted character struggling to do the right thing at the start, but then he has the world's quickest moral quandary about turning to life of crime and then goes completely over the top.
And it's basically,
the job's worth doing.
Ben Mendelsohn says to him, "I used to rob banks." And he seems to look at his beer for about 3 seconds and go, "Okay, I'll rob banks too then."
You can't do that. Go on. All right. There's echoes of that through all the other kind of characters that it leads through. There's possibly interesting things there, but it's sort of squashed down. And the arcs wind up being too rapid to really be believable for any of the characters. And that's a problem. The three parts, you'd have to do an awful lot of dissembling and overanalyzing to convince me that there's any thematic link between any of this stuff, narrative, you know, cyclical natures of life or something. But you'd really be stretching in terms of what you actually get here.
And it's as I was saying, I think you can see that that's where they're going.
Yeah.
And the story goes like the suggestion that this is falling on from other people's things, but there's just not the story to support it.
Sadly, without the story to support it, all you wind up with is a character piece where you wind up having it be about increasingly unsympathetic characters as it goes on, and that is not the most satisfying thing in the world to watch. No.
And the character AJ that I mentioned earlier is spectacularly unsympathetic.
If you're a Gosling fan, I would recommend catching up with this at home and then being prepared to find something else to do after three quarters of an hour.
Exactly. Once Gosling's part is over, so I was going to suggest you, Scott, once Gosling's part is over, you could just switch it off.
Yeah.
Worth the first 40 odd minutes for. He doesn't have much to do, doesn't have much to say, but he's absolutely captivating.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes I really can't see where Craig's coming from with his man crush.
I should hope so. He's mine, damn it. Get your hands off. Can I just say, I thought I had some sort of breaking movie news there as I opened up. I realised I hadn't seen much of the news today apart from Angelina Jolie's quandary and opening up the BBC News app on my iPhone. Not that I wasn't listening to you. Opening up the BBC News app on my phone. Bleary-eyed and tired as I am this week. If you defocus your eyes slightly to sort of replicate that sort of tired effect, scores killed in Nigeria attacks can quite easily be mistaken for Scorsese killed in Nigeria attacks. I quickly realised my mistake. Oh dear. Right then, it's been 5 years since the first Iron Man movie became more of a success than anyone could have expected, largely because Robert Downey Jr. proved so charismatic a lead that the flashbang wallop action almost played second fiddle. A sequel in 2010 unfortunately failed to recapture that lightning in a bottle, despite Downey still proving on form. With regular director Jon Favreau this time stepping aside to allow Shane Black a shot at the helm, can Iron Man 3, set in the aftermath of events of the recent Avengers movie, avoid that old law of diminishing returns and reignite our love of Tony Stark? Well, can it, Scott?
You're right, it's not uncommon for movie series to rather run out of steam by its third installment, and even those designed from the outset to be trilogies often start fizzling out. In even the most successful examples, I don't think many people would say the third outing's the best of a lot of trilogies, but it is with a slight sense of trepidation you may approach Iron Man 3, and a rather gratifying sense of relief when you realise that you could make a pretty credible case for it being the best of the franchise thus far.
Yay.
As you say, it follows on from the events of the Avengers.
Following the Jaws template, then.
Jaws 3 is outstanding, Craig, you're right.
I'm sorry, my brain shut down from the enormous stupidity of that statement. follows on from the events of the Avengers, and there was always the possibility that not having an earth-threatening threat for Robert Downey Jr. and Tony Stark to go up against might be a little bit anticlimactic. But I'm sure comic book aficionados were mollified by the news that the big bad of this film would be the Mandarin, apparently the roguiest of Stark's rogues gallery, or so I'm told, because I don't read the comics, so I don't really know. I'm not a nerd. Anyway, Iron Man 3 sees Pepper Potts, played by Gwyneth Paltrow again, firmly in charge of Stark Enterprises, while Tony sits in his basement and tinkers with endless new suit designs, much to Pepper's annoyance. Turns out that there's more than Stark's usual line of self-absorption going on, as the battle with the nuclear explosions, interdimensional portals and revelations of advanced aliens beating us ill will has rather knocked him for a loop. He's suffering from post-traumatic stress flashbacks, and he gets panic attacks, and he's desperately trying to up his technological game to ward off future threats to the planet, and in particular Pepper, and this has left him in a rather fragile mental state. As such, he is more than happy to ignore the terrorist threat to America, embodied by the Mandarin, played by Sir Ben Kingsley, a mysterious, enigmatic menace seen only in video messages, coming across as something like a hybrid of Osama bin Laden and the Stranger from The Big Lebowski. With the government deciding that...
That's an interesting way to put it.
Yes, that's quite the profile the FBI have put together.
The government is deciding that this is, while it's a serious threat, it's not one that demands calling out the superhero contingent of Marvel's mainstream properties. So a military manhunt is undertaken by James Rhodey Rhodes, or returning Don Cheadle, and in his rebranded Iron Patriot suit, War Machine having deemed a little bit too aggressive PR-wise. Further complicating things are the involvement of Guy Ritchie's Aldrich Killian, another scientific prodigy in the Marvel Universe's already oversubscribed Genius Club. He's hawking Extremis, a wonder drug that can regenerate and heal injured tissue. Handy stuff, but his organisation has something of a reputation for playing fast and loose with safety standards. And given the laws of conservation of characters, I don't think I'm revealing too much to say that he's tied up with the Mandarin and will become another enemy for Tony Stark for kind of poorly explained reasons, but we'll get back to that. After a preemptive strike on Stark's home sees him knocked out and flown autopilot to the other side of America, he's left dragging a battered, non-functional power suit to a small town to repair, regroup, and work out what the hell's going on. You would not thank me for discussing the plot much further, but There's as much, if not more, of Tony Stark in this film than there is Iron Man. Spending so much time without his suit is something of a masterstroke for this film. While I've enjoyed the previous Iron Man films, one much more than two, but even then, the overwhelming CG-ness of the action in them makes for some rather bland set pieces, and the expressionless Iron Mask isn't the most sympathetic protagonist, which is why you get a frequent use of that really awkward in-suit HUD reflection close-up of Downey Jr.'s face so often it just looks really bad.
It's difficult to imagine them inside it.
It does suffer from the, although look, it's a big CGI thing smacking another big CGI thing about Woot problem, isn't it?
Yeah, and in Iron Man 3 it needs to be dug out much less frequently. It still has as many exciting and innovative fights and set pieces, but you can actually see a human face doing most of it, which is quite cool. Stripping Sark from his suit also makes him physically vulnerable, which when combined with the aforementioned emotional vulnerability makes Stark a rather more well-rounded character, and that you can at least come close to imagine might not succeed in his struggle rather than breeze through it, where the last films didn't really have much of a sense of danger for Tony Stark, I felt. And again, we're forcing Stark to rely on his ingenuity and intelligence rather than just wheeling out another multi-billion pound prototype powered armour for this occasion. This makes his character much more interesting, and it makes the excesses of the final set piece much more satisfying. So Iron Man 3 then largely addresses my major issues with the rest of the franchise, and the reasons to like the franchise are still in place, namely Robert Downey Jr. is still there, and he's still as charismatic and as funny as ever. The supporting cast, universally solid, and Kingsley in particular is fantastic. The effects work is as solid as you've seen in a cinema. Perhaps no surprise there, but it is still bloody good. Now, it doesn't make it the perfect summer blockbuster, if you're going to be all boring and analytical about it. The bad guy's motives, in the abstract at least, are sort of sound enough, but the way it ties into Tony Stark is massively contrived. You don't have to look very far to see some gaping plot holes, and this extremist stuff is dangerously close to out-and-out magic in a world that is at least somewhat grounded in technological reality. In fact, as a tightly plotted story, this might well turn out to be the weakest of the three. This, it turns out, does not matter in the slightest, because it's the most enjoyable of them by a good distance. It's perhaps odd to think this is Shane Black's first turn in the director chair for a film with firepower of this magnitude, and indeed it's only his second time in the director's chair at all, and for someone who's been so influential in the action genre for the past few decades, it's kind of odd seeing how restrained he's actually been in his output. And surely it'd have to be seen as a bit of a risk to put Shane Black on this job, but he's knocked it right out of the park, and he's taken some major risks which might infuriate comic purists, given fresh twists on the characters and setting up something close to a fresh start for Stark's next outing, be that either Iron Man 4 or the next Avengers film. It is a brilliant bubblegum tentpole spectacular, and if that's what you're in the mood for, then there is little reason not to love Iron Man 3. Highly recommend it, though.
Yay! Doth thou conclude, Drew?
Da.
Conclude? Sorry.
It's a hoot, is what it is. First of all, before I say anything else, what Scott said about comic book purists not perhaps liking it, I don't give a shit, because there's no such thing as a comic book purist anyway, because there's about 18,000 different versions of every character in comic books anyway, and nobody ever dies.
Just imagine fantasy world is not living up to my personal expectation.
Well, it's not that. If there were a consistent storyline, great, but there's always, like, you know, the ultimate and alternative, and there's the one that's been dead 3 times, 30 times, 2,000 times, whatever it is, isn't it?
I forget if it's officially Marvel or DC that's got about 600 or something officially defined alternate realities.
It's Marvel. Because the Earth we live in is Marvel 616, this much I know from Marilyn Mann podcast. Yeah, but nobody ever dies, like, we're going to kill off a main character and then next week, it was just a dream, or there's a clone now, or it didn't happen, or it was an alternate universe, so fuck you to comic book purists. There's no such thing as a pure comic book anyway, so. Secondly, it's a hoot. Shane Black and Robert Downey Jr. is a combination I very, very much like. I love Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and the fact they're back together in this is fantastic.
Yay!
I believe Jon Favreau's tweet about it was Kiss Kiss Clang Clang, which I think works quite well for this.
I don't have much more to say to Scott does. I'd agree with his point too about the extremist infected or improved characters. It becomes magic and it's a bit annoying. That's one of only two, three minor grumbles I have with the film. These characters are supposed to be able to create great heat due to the regeneration of their body, and I'll buy that for a while, then at the end it's like, no, basically I'm now Superman or something, or the Flash and Superman. Beyond that, it's great. It's really, really funny. It does, as Scott said in our Twitter stream, it does a really good job of putting humour and action in unexpected places. There's a few bits in the middle of really frenetic fights, there's some really really good bits of humour. Ben Kingsley, who has a reputation for taking himself very seriously, is absolutely fantastic, and not taking himself seriously at all in some parts. It's great. I fail to think of anything more to add. It is good. Go see it.
Just to reiterate a point, because I might, looking back at what I said, I may not have hammered the point home, but the action scenes in this bit are really something quite special.
Yeah.
The way it's kind of playing around with him at points, only having like an improvised suit or like improvised like semi-suits and parts of suits and things like that, it makes it a far more interesting action scene for any of these comic book things than possibly, then, well, all of them,
what they've done is
rather than him just strapping on the invincible all-purpose suit.
Yeah.
Well, they've thought, like, we've got this character with these armoured suits, and we know they're sort of, they can be remote-controlled things. And they've sat down, and they seem to have thought of every single thing that could possibly be done with those suits, and done them. Mm. And it's fantastic. They use them in lots of different ways, different scenarios, they do different things with them. It's great. And it's even remarkable, this film, you know, Marvel films are particularly fond of after the credit stingers. Now, given the length of credits in any CGI-heavy film, I would be reticent to say it's worth staying till the end, though I did. But the after the credits scene in this one is easily the best one there's been in a Marvel film yet. It's really quite funny. And if you didn't want to wait for like 7 or 8 hours it takes to get through the credits, that's fine. Just catch up with it. Somebody will likely post it on YouTube or something. But there is a nice after the credits sequence.
Yeah.
But other than that, yeah, see it. It's just, it's a summer blockbuster at its best. It's not ridiculously stupid like a Transformers might be. It's quite witty. It's got great performances. The CGI is spot on. Everything just works in this film. It is deeply, deeply entertaining.
Deep. Well, that sounds rather enticing then.
Yes.
Yeah, I think of the current crop of Marvel films, at least the ones in any way associated with the Avengers, this is far and away the best.
Well, there you have it then. That's our opinion, and if you don't agree with it, you should get your life in order. Thanks as always for listening, and remember, if you want to get in touch, you can email us at podcast@theoneliner.com. You can follow us on Twitter @theoneliner, all one word of course, and you can find us on there individually if the desire should arrest you such. So we will be back in touch with you soon. So listen, take care of yourselves, and we will speak to you again soon. I, as always, have been Craig. Scott was Scott.
Catch you later.
And the D to the R to the E to the W was in fact the D to the R to the E to the W.
Bye bye.
B to the Y to the E to the B to the Y to the E. I think you'll find. Oh, some people. Bye bye.
Lonely. I am so lonely. I have nobody to podcast with. Ah.